I'm Hillary.
And I'm Sandra. Coming up on the podcast, we are going to talk to relationship coach Effie Blue. Now, originally this podcast was going to be about polyandry, but then it became about something completely different.
Yeah, we're going to examine what relationships look like today, what they're going to look like in the future as society moves further and further away from monogamy.
The Quick and the Dirty Podcast with Hillary Welch and Sandra Plagakis.
Well, Hillary, I took the plunge. It happened.
What happened?
Ha-ha! You know how I've been kind of a bitch for the last 4 years?
Is it 4 years? That's it? I thought it was like your whole life.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I'm sorry. You know how I've been bitchier for the last 4 years? I called my doctor and we have now agreed that I am going to start hormone replacement therapy.
Ooh, big step.
Yeah.
So you've been struggling with this for a little while.
Yeah. Like 4 years that I would say that I was in perimenopause, that I would get the sporadic periods. I would get like not hot flashes, but warm flashes. And I basically have been a hot bitch once a month. And like, I've never been so bad, even when I was, you know, having my period. Now it's like, oh my God, get the hell away from me. You might die.
Can we just emphasize hot? Because you are hot.
You know, I know you're appeasing me because I'm terrifying. Please, Hillary, I already love you. We're good. It's fine.
Okay, so can we just talk about how much it sucks to be a woman sometimes? Like, first you get your period and you have to figure out you're not dying.
That's right. And then you have to manage sex in your 20s with your period, because that's like all about time. It's like, God damn it, I'm just trying to get laid here. So yes, your 20s was for me all about just the minefield of my period, dealing with that. And then don't forget the 30s for most of us, or many women. You're lucky if you weren't one of them, actually. Do have to have babies and ruin your vagina. There's that.
Yeah, squeeze a watermelon out of that wee little thing.
Well, little. mine was never the tiniest thing.
Not anymore.
And then in my 40s, that's when perimenopause really started. And it's like, can I not get a fucking break? Literally, can I not just get 10 years where I'm not in pain? Just give me 1 year where I'm not in pain. So this has just, I think, started. It's been exacerbated because of the pandemic. Maybe it's stress that has moved things along, but it's like the warm flashes are like these crazy fucking hot flashes. Like, God help, God help the person who's near me when I have a hot flash now. You know, I'm like a fucking shag rug that somebody just hosed off.
It's not just the booze sweat.
Oh God. That's your kind of sweat, though.
What?
Yes.
Okay. So what does this mean for you going forward? Like, I've heard, I don't know a lot about hormone replacement therapy because I'm not quite there yet, but there are some concerns with it.
I have none because I figure it's got to be better than this. First of all, let me say this. If I could have a hysterectomy and just have my insides removed and my dusty ovaries taken out, I would. In fact, you probably don't even have to remove them. You probably have to just open up my vagina and blow, and the dust will just, just dissipate.
Okay, so you think that like having a hysterectomy is going to fix it?
I wish.
It doesn't. So my mom had a hysterectomy at like 35, and she still went through that like emotional craziness. We just didn't know what the fuck was going on.
Really?
So she didn't get, like, she still kind of hit the menopause even though there was no, like, actual stuff happening.
Okay, so it's like having the phantom cramps that I have right now. You have all these cramps and I don't get a period anymore. It's like, what the goddamn hell is that? Yes, okay. Come on, give me something. You know, you suffer for nothing. The hormone replacement will be, if I can't do the hysterectomy, I'm just doing pills, lowest dose possible of the, estrogen and progesterone, and we'll see what happens.
I wish you the best of luck. And hey, if it just takes off the edge a little bit, it's worth it.
I'm going to mix it with wine. Do you think that'll work? I'm going to crush it into my wine every Saturday night and go, here we go, girls.
But I'm the one with the booze sweats.
I love you. So we've talked about everything on this podcast, from polyamory to polygamy, but we've never talked about something called polyandry. In fact, I just learned the definition of the word recently. Her name is Effie Blue, and I think today on this podcast, she is going to school us of the world of polyandry. So welcome to the podcast, Effie Blue.
Hello, ladies. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Okay, so Effie, Sandra has kind of tried to explain this to me, but I'm a little bit dumb. What is polyandry?
Okay. Here's the very basics of it, right? So polygamy is essentially, which is a sort of big label, like headline, polygamy. Polygamy is about taking multiple spouses. And then polygamy then either becomes polygyny, it's when a man takes multiple wives, or polyandry, when a woman takes multiple husbands. And you really, the thing that distinguishes polygamy and its gendered expressions is marriage. That's at the heart of what makes those relationships polygamous. Polygyny, if you're a man with multiple wives, like a classic harem situation, or polyandry, if you're a woman with multiple husbands, which is a more rare version of this.
So how does that, how does polyamory fit into all of this?
Good question. It does get a little confusing with all the polys, right? Polyamory is essentially maintaining long-term intertwined relationships with more than one person that isn't necessarily, that doesn't call for any kind of contract, be it, a marriage, essentially. And polyamory differs from other expressions of non-monogamy in that there's less emphasis on the dyadic structure, meaning two people, which is what we kind of normally were used to from monogamy. But then when you go into non-monogamy, you get people maybe on the monogamous side, open relationship, swinging. Those are still come from the dyad, from a couple structure at the core of it. And then they kind of then open from there. Polyamory is less couple based, although there are dyadic pairing, that they're pairings within polyamorous structures, but it isn't necessarily centered around a couple. So that's kind of polyamory. The big difference between polyamory and polygamy, where polyandry lives under, is marriage, to be honest.
Okay, so what you're saying is in polyandry, even though technically speaking you can't have multiple legal husbands, on a relationship level or in your mind, you would have multiple husbands within that relationship to one female.
Polyandry, polygamy, polygamy is all about marriage.
So why, but the bigger question would be, why the hell would any woman want more than one husband? In my experience, one has been a pain in the ass. Why would I want multiple men in my life and marry them and keep them around? What is the benefit of polyandry? That's a big question, by the way. I get that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it comes from like what you think about relationships, right? So if you're married and you have a relationship with, your husband, and you're like, oh my God, this person is so much, the idea of having multiple of those seems like, well, this is crazy notion, right? But if your relationships are, healthy and thriving and they contribute to your life, then the idea of multiplying them seems like a great idea, right? So it really depends on how you look at relationships. That sort of makes a difference. Also, so even though what we just talked about is very, very theory based and on paper, right? We said the main difference between polygamy and polyandry and polyamory is just marriage. But we also have to realize that within the social systems that we live in, the social sort of construct that we live in, there are inherent power dynamics that are built into marriage, right? Which is something that you don't necessarily get with polyamory, which is there's no marriage contract involved in polyamory. So besides like the technical on paper, they're about the same thing, but really with marriage, when you do add the marriage piece into it, there are inherent power dynamics that get installed into that relationship. Of course, there is no legal way of getting married to more than one person. So it ends up being really played out through power dynamics of whatever the, you know, the sort of husband-wife power dynamics there is in the relationship. Does that make sense?
Okay, so let's get away from the theoretical and get into the real life.
Sure.
Now, this is this something that you live, and what does it mean in your world? Because like, I think it gets confusing when we talk about sort of the theory, but in your world, what does polyandry look like?
So in my world, honestly, I don't really come across people who identify as polyandrous very much. So the closest thing to what I see... and the reason for that is because it's technically not legal, right? It's not something that people can go out there and sort of really legalize. So they tend to be like smaller communities, often intertwined with like religious practices. And then, you know, every now and then you get people who are like practicing it in this very like spousal kind of way. What I see most of is the closest thing that I see is a polyfidelity. And polyfidelity is essentially a group of people who decided that they are going to have a closed relationship within that group. So, for example, if you have a woman with two men that she's intertwined with and in a relationship with, and nobody else, and no one's taking any more partners, and no one's having sex with anybody else, that is technically polyfidelity. And I do see that a lot. I do see people who are in those kind of relationship, and it works for them. The reason why it works for them is, at least some of the reasons that I've heard, is more people, more support. For example, more people, more support structure, more people available means that needs can be met by multiple people. So there are people who do it for many, many reasons, and some of them, in terms of polyfidelity. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You know, I was wondering, back to the polyandry, and again, not to get so technical, mm-hmm. but I'm somewhat obsessed with the notion, even though I know it's probably not common in the least, but mm-hmm. what... I can only guess why it would be beneficial to a woman, maybe because she has that support, et cetera. But why would polyandry be beneficial to men? Like, I think of sister wives. Are these like brother husbands? You know what I mean?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's the same idea, pretty much, that you kind of, the structure works for you, like brother husbands. Yeah. And it makes sense. Depends on the relationship structure you have, right? So if you are somebody maybe who needs a lot of space, right? You want to be in a relationship with someone, but you're somebody who needs a lot of space, and your partner is someone who needs a lot of attention, right? Let's give the scenario. So in that pairing, people's needs aren't being met, right? You have somebody who has who wants a lot of attention, a lot of connection. You have somebody who doesn't necessarily want to meet them there because it doesn't work for them. Maybe they're an introvert. Adding someone into that mix allows for extra, extra attention, or somebody else to kind of, pick up the slack or be present when you can't be present, right? So I think in any of these situations, you're just looking for a, ideally, it's a kind of a collaborative experience. And that's why people choose them.
Like, now, historically, I mean, from what I've read, like polyandry, it mostly comes from sort of a peasant kind of lifestyle where like land or families need more support for keeping land or getting things done. So like a group of brothers, like literal brothers, would all sort of have one female, or maybe it's because there aren't a lot of females in a certain culture,
right,
or like in a certain space. But like, what is I think in the modern world, like there's less need for it. I guess maybe emotionally you want to do a lot more talking, and maybe your guy doesn't want to do a lot of talking.
So yeah. three men equals one emotional person, like in total.
That's funny. Or childcare, right? So you're right in that sort of the more rural, more sort of third world countries, or like old, historically, it's resource management. It can definitely be a resource management thing. But also in our modern life, childcare is huge. So again, it's a resource management thing. You can have more adults to take care of kids.
Oh, I love it. So, and someone to mow the lawn, and you never have to worry. One does the lawn, one takes out the garbage, one watches the baby.
I was going to say, the garbage is taken care of, the lawn is taken care of, the car's being washed.
I love it.
But it seems less common that there's like one female and multiple men, only because like I frankly would rather be in a sister wife kind of situation, because then at least I got to do less.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's interesting that you say that. So what I find really fascinating is when I talk to people about these non-traditional structures is that everybody tends to have a version of what it's going to look like, and then they have a reaction to that, right? So, like, for example, we're sort of joking about a very heteronormative structure, right? We joked about the garbage and the lawn. We're looking for, like, very gender norms, heteronormative setup. And then we're talking about, these non-traditional relationships within that from that lens. And I think the heteronormative and gender-rolled lens makes more sense under polygamy and polyandry, because those are more traditional. Actually, they're closer to traditional setups than something like polyamory, right? Because polygamy, polyandry is mimicking marriage, right, which is a traditional setup with just multiple people. So I think some of that is also to do with, people who tend to be more on the traditional side of things.
I don't understand. You know, when I think of like back to the polyandry and the polygamy, I couldn't, like Hillary, you said that you would, be more apt to be a sister wife. I would hate to be a sister wife because I would always feel like I'd be competing with my sisters for the man's attention, because that's the way women are socialized, because we're constantly competing for men, or so it feels like. So and the feelings, I would want to know that I was the favorite. That would be the only way it could work, but it doesn't work
exactly
that way.
This is exactly what I'm talking about, right? It's a very personal point of view. Like, you're like, oh, jealousy would creep in.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, of course. And then I think Sandra was like, oh, no, then I wouldn't have to do so much, right? So to me, that gives me a lot of, clues to how you're showing up in your relationships, for example, your current relationships, or how you show up in relationships in general, how you view them, right? So a lot of this stuff is definitely colored by what you feel that your role is in a relationship, as a man, as a woman, or wherever you end up. Also, how you imagine relationships to play out. And often we have those installed in because of what we've seen so far, what we see in the media, what social norms are. So we have these images of what a relationship looks like, or what a person's role within the relationship looks like. And then we think of anything else from that lens. So I can totally see, I'm with you, Hillary. I would have initially have thought if I was partnered with somebody who already has another partner, I would have guessed when I first started practicing non-monogamy that I would be jealous too. Like, that's where I would imagine I'd be. Having been in multiple relationships where I've dated a man with another woman, I've actually found those to be some of the most nourishing relationships I've ever had with my metamor, right? So my lover's lover, which is something that I would not have predicted at all. I would have predicted tension. I would have predicted competition. I would have predicted threat, that it was going to be a really difficult relationship to manage. Personal experience has been quite the opposite. Some of the women, in fact, all of the women whom I shared a partner with are like some of my dearest, closest female friends. And even though we're not dating the same guy, we've remained friends and a support network and like dear, close, like sister from another mother type of situation.
That sounds like the perfect world.
Depends.
That sounds like a great scenario. Hillary, you and I would make great sister wives together, though. That's true.
Yeah. Would we, though? Because we're both like, I think we would want...
I'm pretty shitty in bed. I'm pretty shitty in bed, and you probably are way better than, I'm terrible in bed. But Hillary, you would be great. So there would be balance, but then I could fulfill the other needs. Like, I'd be a shitty wife. Never mind. I don't want a man. I take it all back.
So, Effie, I'm not sure how comfortable you are speaking about your current situation, but what does your current relationship situation look like?
So currently, personally, I am probably the closest thing to the label would be solo poly, meaning I have multiple relationships that I'm sort of... I'm in, and some of them are long-term and some of them are new. None of them are particularly more important than the other. So I have sort of multiple relationships that I nurture, you know, different times, different lengths. But that's kind of where I am right now. Historically, I've been in what some people call kitchen table poly relationships, where all my partners and I were able to sort of sit around the table once a month, break bread, catch up. And it was like an extended micro community or a support network. So that's kind of where I, like what, where my relationships tend to be. And that's kind of where I find myself thriving when I feel kind of autonomous within myself and have multiple relationships that know about one another and sort of, at least a foundational friendship across everyone.
Okay. So on paper, what you're doing sounds absolutely perfect. But do you have to learn how to do that? Meaning we've all, you talked about all of us being socialized a certain way. We've all grown up seeing what a traditional relationship should be. Yet we're now learning that those relationships don't work for more than 50% of the population.
So
how do you learn how to have these polyamorous relationships? Like, how do you learn to not be jealous? How do you learn to communicate? How do you learn to not catch feelings for every single person that you're romantically involved with? How do you learn how to do it?
For sure. So actually, firstly, you kind of have to unlearn a bunch of things, which is kind of the, you know, you have to unlearn a bunch of things before you can learn how to be polyamorous. And you kind of let go of societal structures and expectations, and then rebuild with aligned with what you need, right? So the work that I do, I'm a relationship coach, and I work with people who are curious about or transitioning into non-monogamy. And then where we normally start is like, know thyself. We kind of go in and work on who are we, how do we show up in relationships. I do a lot of work around emotional literacy, meaning you're able to identify, like you're able to feel your feelings, identify your feelings, put words to them, communicate to the other person or persons how you're feeling, be able to listen to what they have to say and like empathize and have compassion. So these skills are good for any relationship, of course. They become absolutely crucial if you are stepping out of the monogamous structure. Because the monogamous structure comes with default settings that the society has already installed. So you can get away with not being a great communicator. Not for long, but you can get away with it for a little bit. So when you're stepping out of that and you're kind of creating something from scratch and you're sort of stepping into a territory that is not socially supported, you really have to do the work. Going back to what you said about jealousy. Jealousy is a human emotion. It is a part of our portfolio of emotions that we feel. And people who are, you know, non-monogamous might be more exposed to situations that might trigger jealousy. But ultimately, it is a human emotion. What you can do about jealousy is to learn to regulate yourself around it. So learn to metabolize jealousy, and there are many, many ways of doing that. Jealousy is essentially a message that you're getting from your psyche that there's something wrong, and that something wrong can be many things. It could be that you have an insecurity that needs to be handled. It could be a need not being met. It could be a fear of being left out or left behind. It could be an old trigger from an old trauma, an old experience, right? So with jealousy, you just have to be curious and investigate what's causing it. And once you get to what's causing it, you kind of have to deal with it at that level.
But like, from what I've understood is like, jealousy is not a one-sided problem. Like if you have if you have a problem with jealousy, that's one thing. But if you have a feeling of jealousy, is that not something that needs to be addressed by both partners? Because it's stemming from something that's either, like you said, like a fear that's mm-hmm. coming from something maybe greater in your relationship, or mm-hmm. there's something that's triggering that something that's happening that needs to be addressed, that's not necessarily just one partner's responsibility.
So it depends what you excavate, right? So you feel jealous, you go digging, you're curious, you wonder like, oh, this jealousy is coming out, what's going on with me? You excavate and you find that, you know, it's an insecurity that you carry around. And really, you can ask for help around that insecurity, but the insecurity belongs to you. So really, the most sustainable, long-term, robust thing you can do is to deal with your own insecurity so it's not coming up for you, right? It's like, it's a path to growth in that way. Alternatively, you can definitely ask your partner or your partners not to do certain things that trigger those feelings. But that's not always, you know, it's not always the case. I mean, there are many, many situations I deal with my clients where, you know, the partner is saying like they're doing everything they were asked, and the person is still feeling jealous because the jealousy is living inside them and not necessarily with their partner. Now, having said this, there are definitely things that your partner can do that can trigger you, right? And if it's to do with them, if it's to do with maybe like keeping secrets in a very specific way, or not being in integrity, saying one thing, doing something else, and it's triggering unsafety, insecurity, then it is a two-way. It's something that you can tackle between the two or three of you, whoever is in that dynamic. But it is not necessarily, oh, I'm jealous, it's to do with the other person. You know, you need to sort of understand the anatomy of your jealousy and where it's coming from and address it. If it's internal and your own stuff, you have to address it with yourself. It's to do with your partner, you can have an open dialogue and see where you end up with that. But it's not necessarily automatically the other person.
So, well, I would agree with that too, because I know someone, she's younger, she had a boyfriend, and one day she caught him going through her phone, and he found all these DMs on Instagram from, you know how social media is. Mm-hmm. There's all these randos that DM pretty girls and you don't know them. Mm-hmm. So she had all these randos who were DMing her, and she didn't respond, but he became very enraged, very jealous, even though she didn't invite it. And the truth was that he'd been cheated on multiple times in past relationships. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, it's not your issue, sweetheart. It's 100% his insecurity, even... Mm-hmm. You're a new person, but he's still reliving those old feelings with you. Is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
I should be a coach. Look at me. I'm good.
Do it. More of us, the better. People need help with relationships. It's like it's crazy to me that relationships is one of the most integral part of our lives, our well-being, and our society as a whole. Therefore, our like species level, it's really important that we become good at relationships. With that in mind, there's so little help and there's so little instruction that's built into our curriculums, our, you know, educational systems, particularly about relationships and relating and all the other skills that's required to be good in relationships. Things like conflict resolution, things like negotiation, things like reflective listening and good communication. Like, none of these things are covered. And then we wonder why people are stuck at relationships.
Holy shit, that's brilliant. Holy shit. Yes. Yes, and stop showing little girls Disney movies, for fuck's sakes.
Yes.
That's not helping.
Yeah.
It's not helping.
Yeah, I mean, true. People in the sex education world always say, you know, learning sex from porn is like learning how to drive from Fast and the Furious. Like, that's something that they say, and it's very, very true. There's a difference between education and entertainment. Same goes for relationships. Learning to do relationships through like rom-coms and Disney is like, you know, it's entertainment. That's entertainment. That's not where we learn how we relate to one another. But we don't have education around that. We don't have like robust systems built in, tools and skills that are age appropriate that we teach our kids as they grow older. You know, we don't do any of that. And then we wonder why divorce rate is at 50%, you know?
Why do you think the traditional relationship is dying? And I say it's dying because so many people have these non-traditional relationships now. And I don't know, like, first of all, let me just ask you this. What is a percentage, do you suppose, of people who are seeking the non-traditional relationship compared to the traditional?
So the last research data that I read was millennials were reporting about 49 to almost 50% of the millennials were saying they're going to go for, they are already going for, or they imagine themselves to be in non-monogamous relationships. And that wow. research came out, I think, about 3 years ago. So that's kind of where, that's the latest data that I know.
Yeah, but I also feel like there's part of that, part of that, though, Effie, do you think it's just people who don't want the hassle of being in a relationship or they want to fuck around? Or is that people actually considering having real committed or not necessarily committed, but emotionally deep relationships that are non-committal or polyamorous? Like, how much of that is people just wanting to fuck around and or people wanting to, like, really
get
deep with people?
Yeah, I find, so it's very hard to know until they're doing it, right? So these are people reporting within, you know, within a research situation. What I find, though, is people who claim to be polyamorous tend to be very committed people. They are they're willing to commit to multiple relationships, right? I think it's a misconception that polyamorous people are commitment phobes, because when I look at them, those people who are genuinely leaning into the structure, practicing it, getting better at it, and you know, that's really how they want to live and love, they tend to be people who are actually very comfortable committing, and they're willing to commit to multiple relationships. I think, yes, non-monogamy has been used as a shorthand for I don't want to commit, especially on dating sites. But I think that's just, appropriation, you know, it's appropriation and kind of like misrepresentation, I should say. Not appropriation, misrepresentation. And I say this to people all the time, like, are you non-monogamous or are you just dating? Because it sounds like you're dating, and you're dating, that's what you should just be saying, I'm dating. It's okay to be just dating multiple people. It's when you say things like, I'm non-monogamous, I'm polyamory, that's when you're talking about your relationship structures. If you're not ready to be in a relationship, then you're dating and you should just date. And that's okay, right? I think that's a distinction.
Why is it that people don't really date anymore? Like, it used to be that you would just, like, date multiple people, maybe be intimate, maybe not, and then settle down. And now it's like everybody gets right into commitment.
Yeah, I mean, so it's kind of interesting. Like, going back to the question that you asked earlier, which is what's happening with the tradition? Like, why the traditional relationships aren't working, right? I think it's because they're not so traditional. The modern marriage as we know it is only like 100 years old. If we really look at tradition, how humans have bonded over like the millennia that we've been around, is not the dyadic nuclear family that we see today. That's really been a thing in the last 100 years. Historically, marriage was really about property and land ownership and knowing your bloodlines. That's when marriage as a contract were really installed into our civilization, is to sort of keep track of women and babies and land and making sure that, you know, the resources were allocated to the right people in your life. And that came about during the agricultural revolution, when we started to farm land and land became like something that you owned, right? But if you look at evolutionarily, we are designed to be in micro communities of around 150 people. So our brains have connection structures that can really meaningfully hold up to 150 connections, which align with this idea of a nomadic tribe, right? Which is the most of our evolution, we've been existing in nomadic tribes, which are interconnected micro-community structures. And even within that, this idea of pair bonding, you don't really see it, right? There is child rearing that happens. And then once the children come about, the village or the tribe kind of take on the rearing of the children together. So there isn't as much of this, here is mom, here is dad, here's a nuclear family, and they live in their little hut and then they don't, you know, they don't really like have anybody else around them. That's very, very new. And I think the reason why it's not working is because we're not designed for it. That's why they're breaking, right? We're supposed to be in bigger support networks, right? We're not supposed to put ourselves in a situation when one person is our everything, our friend, our lover, our confidant, our teacher, or, you know, the one reflective surface that we get all our feedback from, right? It's just not a sustainable model. That's why they're not working, I think.
So you would say that the traditional family as we know it, or I should say the traditional relationship, not family, as we know it, just isn't working? Because I would agree with that statement. I don't know too many people who are in happy long-term marriages. I know a handful, actually.
Yeah. They're not working. And I would see, here's what I would be really interested in. Those people that you know, if you were to talk to them for a while, my guess is that they would either, if they're really healthy and thriving with that relationship, within that relationship, I bet there is an extended support network around it. Like, they have a good relationship with their family. They have friend groups that they, like, there is more to it than this one couple that you're saying, oh, they're in a long-term happy relationship, right? Or people stay together for a long, 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 you know, people stay together if they're not thriving. Like, that's the other thing. There is a school of thought, like, it's for life and you're in a relationship and you're just not going to get out of it because that's what you decided that you're going to do. So there's, like, with the couples that are thriving over long-term relationships, I'd be interested in sort of looking at their lives and seeing what's enabling them to stay in the relationship. Are they thriving? And if they're thriving, my guess would be that they have a big support network, support structure around the relationship.
So then the question becomes, like, how do you know it's time to go? Like, how do you know that either your poly relationship or your marriage should come to an end? Because we do have ebbs and flows in life. Things are not always easy. Things get difficult. We try to work through them, and then maybe we can and maybe we can't.
Mm-hmm. So some of the work that I do with clients is around relationship transitions. So I don't, again, this idea of that when do you go, like when does the relationship end, is a monogamous idea, right? The idea is that you're either in a relationship or you're out of a relationship. If you're in a relationship, if you want to, your only option is to end it and get out, right? The work that I do is a lot about, okay, can we transition the relationship into something that makes sense for everyone, right? Can this idea of a relationship be a fluid, ever-evolving, ever-changing thing that aligns with the needs and the truth of the people in it, right? So the ebbs and flows are essentially a transitioning, like the relationship is transitioning. Now you can do it consciously, or you can just like be in the drift of it and sort of wonder, like, I wonder if this, we're gonna make it. I wonder, oh, like we're having a lot of fun right now. I wonder how long this is going to last, or we're going through a tough patch, so maybe we're not going to make it, right? That's when you're kind of in the drift of it. Versus if you are consciously designing your relationship, you can say, okay, so there is a, you know, there seems to be some tension. What's going on? What do the people need? How can we meet those needs? Can we meet each other's needs? Do we need to reach out to, you know, other people to meet those needs? And then see what the relationship can look like that is aligned with the needs of the people in it, without necessarily saying, okay, I don't want to see you anymore. Like, this relationship is now over, and then it's, you know, it's gone. A lot of the work that I do is around, okay, well, what can the relationship look like now that you have different needs, or you have had this one experience, or you want to do this, like, you want to explore this particular thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, so we talk about, like, let's say the millennials, for example. You touched on that a second ago about how almost 50% of them are seeking these polyamorous relationships, as they call them. Mm-hmm. But what about if you've been married for, you know, 30 years and you know that you're not going to, your retirement is on the horizon and things are shitty? Do you see a lot of couples that are trying to reinvent their whole relationship structure late in the game?
Yes. Yeah. No. I definitely. I client-wise, I have a lot of empty nesters, where they've kind of like stuck together, and they brought up the children, and the children have gone, and they're kind of living their second, you know, you know, second phase of their relationship or whatever. Yeah, and they're looking at what they can, you know, what they can explore now, be it a new partner, or they want to start going to sex parties, or they want to try to date together maybe. So yeah, there's a lot of people who, you know, after decades, two decades of being together, are looking to see, like, what else can they do? How can their relationship evolve and change to look differently?
Yeah, I commend.
And good for them.
I commend them. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, exactly. You can throw in the towel, or you can try to make it work for you and have those open and honest conversations. That's, if it works for them, wow, great.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just want to add just something, since your listeners we're talking about this, I want to make sure that there's accurate information. So I just want to say polyamory, just like polygamy, is kind of very on the fringes, right? Meaning, even though it's my structure, I always say this to people, that it's not for everyone. It's really on the fringes. What I see a lot of are open relationships where, like I said at the beginning, there is a dyad, there is a couple in the middle, and there's a relationship that is assigned to that couple, and they date other people, or they date other people together or separately. That seems to be way more common these days. So this idea of, like, I'm going to have multiple intertwined romantic long-term relationships that we might all live together and maybe even have kids together and mix our finances situation, polyamory, tends to be on the rarer side than couples in open relationships.
Yeah, right, like now. You have your couple right that is your main couple, and then you have guest right stars from time to time that may come and
right
go.
Right. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So ooh, that seems to be the most common structure that I see right now. It'll be interesting to see the millennials. I mean, we talk about millennials, but they're now 30, so they're very much adults. And it'll be interesting to see what that wave is going to look like. I mean, so there's some interesting things happening because of the quarantine. I don't know if you are following any of this, but because of the way that we're cut off from a lot of our bigger social circles, people are kind of quarantining and coming into smaller groups where they're either living together or sort of having a virtual bubble around them to say, here's the group of people that I'm going to interact with during this quarantine. And we're going to make sure that our risk tolerances are the same and our safety protocols are the same. And we're going to, like, this is going to be our little huddle during this quarantine. I'm definitely seeing a lot of that happening. And then those quarantines are growing growing emotions and sort of relationships around it that is romantic or sexual. So that's going to be kind of interesting to see what happens post pandemic. Or are we, you know, are they going to stay? Have we now evolved into a new relationship structure? Like, that I'm excited to see in a few years.
What are relationships going to look like in 20 years from now? I mean, when you think about the traditional relationship sort of on its deathbed right now and gasping for air, in 20 years mm-hmm from now, our kids, are they going to have like multiple partners? What's the family going to mm-hmm look like? I mean, when you think about it, you mentioned the family, the idea of the nuclear family is only 100 years old mm-hmm anyway. So in another mm-hmm 100 years, what's it going to be? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I find where the relationships are going to go has the one of the main indicators is how feminism is doing and how women are treated within the culture has a lot to do with where relationships go, right? So if you look at countries, the Scandinavian countries, where there is, you know, support for the families, for the women, right from the beginning, right? So they have paternity care. The government covers the first 7 years of the child's life with anything from diapers to food to formula, all that kind of stuff. When you look at those societies where there is true equality between the genders, and I'm being binary here right now, is that those are post-marriage societies. Sweden, Denmark, those are all have plummeting marriage rates. Because people don't see the reason to get married anymore, because the marriage contract is all about safety and security and property, And for women, for many years, that was the only way that you could have any kind of existence in the world. Like, you were attached to your husband, you were attached to your father. That's how you, like, that's what gave you, like, permission to exist. And then you got passed on to your husband, and then you were under his name, right? If you think about the way that we, our names are working, right? So as that changes, as women are becoming more autonomous, as hopefully we're going to get to more and more equality, in the social space and the workspace, that I think there's going to be a less need for marriage if we get there, right? I feel like most of the time it's like three steps forward, two steps back. But I think if you really want to take a guess to what relationships are going to look like, you kind of want to follow how society is treating women, I think.
That's a good answer.
But do you think that we're going to always have a level of commitment in our relationships? Like, do you think that is part of who we are as human beings, or is commitment period going to go by the wayside? I'm not saying in a contractual marriage way, but in an emotional commitment sense.
Mm-hmm. So commitment to what, though?
Commitment to people in our lives, to our relationships. Doesn't matter what those relationships look like, but long-term commitment on an emotional level.
Sure, but committing to what? Are you committing to be with them till the day they die? Are you committing to, are you committing to fidelity, sexual fidelity? Are you committing to a quality of life? Are you committing to a physical
presence? I don't even think it matters. Do you think, like, just, like, committing emotionally to being part of their life in some sort of way, to being an emotional mm-hmm. support?
Yeah, I think that's the part of our species, right? This is the 150 connections, meaningful connections that I was talking about. We are very much designed to be committed to to others. We are pack animals. We seek safety and belonging in groups. So we are very much wired to commit and to be a part of other people and other relationships. So I think that commitment piece is human. It's what we turn that commitment into, and with that commitment, what kind of obligations that we're assigning to that commitment is when things become a little murky, right? Saying that I'm going to be there for somebody emotionally and to support them, and, you know, you can commit to being a good communicator, whatever you're committing to, you can do that, and we are wired to do that. It's what you put on top of that commitment is where it becomes, like, that's why I was asking, like, committing to what? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It means don't write a check your ass can't cash.
Yes, exactly.
We do a lot of writing checks, don't we, with each other, but there's not a lot of check cashing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and also the way that we think about our relationships is so heavily influenced by. I am a founder of an organization called Curious Fox. We do, it's a community for those who challenge the status quo in love, sex, and relationships. And we talk a lot about what we call the noise. And essentially the noise is anything from what's on TV, what we hear within our, you know, social bubbles, what's in our social feeds. So, like, this tsunami of noise and prescription and expectation that kind of comes our way that we don't always, like, we don't always receive it consciously. It's kind of, it can be very insidious, right? So within that noise, there are a lot of prescriptions about what relationships should be like. And I think this is what I was saying about it. We need to do a lot of unlearning of what a relationship is and to really get in touch with ourselves of what is it that we need out of a relationship, right? If one of the reasons you want to be in a relationship is that you are with somebody who takes the garbage out and mows the lawn, so you need, like, essentially a collaborative life partner, right? That is okay. Let's just call it that, you know? And not necessarily, like, romanticize it into something else and then end up in another relationship and end up in the reality of it and then be disappointed.
Yeah, I think too much. I think you've brought up some really great points. And for me, I like the idea of, or I think the most interesting thing that I've learned with you right now, Effie, is that many of us go into relationships thinking society has told us what a traditional relationship is. And many of us don't go into a relationship saying, okay, what is it that I want from a relationship? What do I actually need? Mm-hmm. And yeah, we should all mm-hmm. fill out a giant questionnaire when we're 15 mm-hmm. years old in school, like you were saying, and figure out who we are before we start embarking in these traditional relationships that we may not even be suited for. And ultimately, families are destroyed because we don't know who we are at the start of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in funny you should say that, because my collaborative partner and I, we literally just designed that survey. We designed a big workbook to give you a snapshot of who you are and what you need. And it's a very guided experience of the know thyself piece of the relationship by design component, where we go through and ask about, like, what does it look like when you're happy? What does it look like when you're sad? What, you know, when there's conflict, what do you do? Do you shut down or do you need to talk it out? Do you need a lot of space or do you need, like, to be with people all the time? To really break down and reflect on who you are and how you show up. And, by the way, it needs to be a living document, because we change and we evolve and we learn, right? So doing it at 15 is a great start. And then ideally you're doing it every year. Right? You're reflecting, is it still what I want? Is it still what I need in my life? Is this still the vision that I can subscribe to? And it's something that we need to get into the habit of doing, like self-reflection and then redesign of our relationships and our lives.
You know, and I find it really interesting too, because you're speaking more in terms of relationships that are a little less than the societal norm. But even for couples who are going into like a monogamous, say you want to get married, when you talked about understanding what your relationship and what it is you actually really want and to define it in that way, I think that that sets the expectation for your relationship. Like if what you really want mm-hmm. is somebody to take out the garbage and mow the lawn, mm-hmm. but the other person has this idea that they want like this all-encompassing, you know, Disney lifestyle where we're just so enamored with each other, but the other person's not really looking for that, you're just like, you're setting yourself up for disappointment.
For sure, for sure. I mean, some of the questions that first of all, you're absolutely right. Monogamy and non-monogamy, there's a lot to be gained from being clear about self-reflection and knowing what we want out of relationships and what we want our relationships to look like, period. And sometimes we forget about that because monogamy is just feels like, oh, monogamy is all the same, you know? Like, is it though? Because some of the questions I ask people, right? So you're saying you're monogamous, which means you're sexually fidelitous. So does sexting count, right? Like sexting is like right? Does sexting count? Does flirting count? So there's like all these nuances where you can really, it's not as clear cut, even if you're in a monogamous relationship.
Does porn count?
There are other things outside of sex that are important in keeping a relationship happy, whether it's monogamous or not.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's say you have a guy who's like, you know, pays the bills, you know, never cheated in his life, but is not a good father figure, is not interested in being a father figure, right? And you got married thinking you're going to have a kid and you're going to have a father figure, right? This person can be, you know, a great person, you know, never cheats on you, pays the bills, takes the garbage out, mows the lawn, but is just not interested in being a father, right? Doesn't necessarily make that person a bad person or a bad partner, but there's a big misalignment in what the relationship and the other people need and what they're willing to give. So you're right. I mean, just getting a relationship right requires a lot of thinking and a lot of communication and reflection. And we just don't tell people that. We tell people that if you seek high and low, you overcome obstacles, you find the one, and you live happily ever after, is what we tell them.
That's the lie we tell them.
This is not how it works, you know? Yeah, and then we wonder that, you know, and then people are lost. They're just like, why am I not living happily ever after? Like, they either think, like, either something is wrong with them, or they haven't found the one, that something is wrong with their partner. We never think, oh, maybe something is wrong with this myth that they told me.
Yeah, I that's a very interesting way to look at it, but it probably is your partner, let's be honest. Oh, no. I'm kidding.
Speaking from experience,
I'm just kidding. Effie Blue, thank you so much for joining us on the Quick and the Dirty podcast today. That was an awesome conversation. Honestly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This episode is over, but the conversation doesn't have to be. Follow Hillary and Sandra on social. Instagram at Hillary on Air, at SandraKiss1053. Twitter at Hillary Welch, at SandraKiss1053. And on Facebook at Quick and Dirty Podcast. Got a question? Email Hillary and Sandra, thequickandthedirty@gmail.com. Don't forget, you can download the podcast each week to your mobile device to listen offline. Find The Quick and the Dirty on frequencypodcastnetwork.com, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcasts.